Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We're joined by the executive director at Alianza Americas, a network of migrant-led organizations working in the U.S. and transnationally to create an inclusive, equitable, and sustainable way of life for communities across North, Central, and South America. Oscar Chacon, thank you for joining us.
The decision made by the Supreme Court regarding some people who happen to be beneficiaries of temporary protected status, or TPS. We were more or less prepared for it, but it still surprised us. And we had a very busy day already planned with the visit of Vice President Kamala Harris to Guatemala and then to Mexico. But then we had to also deal with the Supreme Court decision.
What is your reaction to some of the things that Vice President Harris said and proposed in Guatemala?
First of all, let me point out that one good piece of news, you know, going back even to the electoral campaign last year, is that then candidate Joe Biden, now President Joe Biden, said very clearly that the migration that we were seeing from Central American countries was essentially a humanitarian challenge. And that in order to grasp what's going on and articulate an adequate solution, it was necessary for the U.S. to focus on the so-called root causes of migration. I've been working on these issues for close to 40 years, and I had never ever heard a U.S. president saying anything close to that. Once the administration came into force, the president designated Vice President Kamala Harris as his person in charge to address migration from Central American countries, and I should say increasingly from Mexico as well, but also the so-called root causes of migration. So her visit in that respect needs to be understood as a first step in a process that will likely be a several-month process to be able to come up with a strategy that responds to what the president has been, again, describing as a need to focus on root causes of migration. I believe that the administration has already found itself in a somewhat contradictory predicament, because on one hand, the instinct of wanting to do things differently than Donald Trump, that I know, as a matter of fact, intend well, I mean, they really want to do things differently than Donald Trump, has already begun clashing with other people in the administration who are basically saying, what we need to do is be very careful with how we handle anything about immigrants and immigration, because this will come back to haunt us in the context of the 2022 midterm election. So what we saw during the visit by the vice president, first to Guatemala, is a public speech, you know, that she gave and that became viral immediately, because she pretty much said, do not come, because we will continue to enforce our laws, which was a way of saying, you know, we will arrest you, we will deport you, we will detain you. And in all honesty, I have to say, I know, as a matter of fact, you know, because of past meetings we have had with then Senator Kamala Harris, that she knows better. She knows absolutely why people are fleeing their countries. And she must know that just to tell people do not come doesn't cut it. You know, it doesn't really serve any purpose, because we are talking about people almost in a similar situation to a house totally engulfed by flames, and people are on a third floor. And no matter how much you tell them that it is very dangerous to jump from the third floor, they still do it. Why? Because the fire is going to kill them. And that's exactly the situation we have going in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. So what we are still debriefing is what else happened while the vice president was in Guatemala, because we know that there was a lot more that got to be talked about, namely issues of corruption, impunity, narco-trafficking, economic inequality, issues of racism affecting primarily indigenous populations in Guatemala. We know that all those issues were actually addressed. To what degree any agreements came about, I cannot tell you. I interpret her visit to Guatemala as the only place in Central America she could go now because of the difficulties with Honduras and the increasing difficulties with El Salvador, is that it is a first step. And from there, we need to keep pressing so that the administration doesn't fall back into what's predictable, which is a position to say, okay, we will do more of what we've been doing before with the same people that we've been doing it before, and we are hoping for different results. That would be absolutely crazy.
This is almost, to me, a situation of reparations. The arrogance of the U.S. returning to Guatemala and lecturing, whether it's about, we're going to give you a certain amount of money, use it, the issues of corruption, and let's really expose and undress. In this case, it seems to me, the emperor's new clothes. That being, see, the foreign policy that has inured on the part of the U.S. in Latin America that has forced migration. Well, why don't we start there? Because I'm a little more perturbed at the kind of chauvinism that seemed to me to be part of the presentation of Kamala Harris in Latin America on immigration.
I think it's rather almost surreal that here we have the first black children of immigrants from Asia and in the Caribbean, vice president of the U.S., going to essentially advance what purportedly it's a new policy approach by the U.S. But I think it is very important what you're bringing up. I think that this is something that, at least in our exchanges with the State Department and people that are working with the vice president, we have said very clearly, what you are up against is the past of what you've done. The past relationship of the U.S. over many, many years, if not centuries, is precisely why we have the horrible conditions that we have in countries like Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and several others throughout Latin America. Let's not even talk about the past as if it is the past from 40, 50, 60 years ago. No, I'm talking about the past even as of very recently. The nation that was regarded as the most trusted partner of the U.S. in Central America up until recently was Honduras. The government that we now have in Honduras is the evolution of the blessing given by the U.S. to the coup d'etat in 2009. Those events have brought us, you know, the guy who is now the president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who we all now know it's implicated very heavily in narcotraffic, in militarism, in corruption in Honduras. For the U.S. to actually come in and pretend that nothing happened in the past, it's a very tall order to surmount. And in that respect, I mean, that's why I said earlier, I mean, that to me, some of the things that they've been saying do represent a breath of fresh air, but they don't erase, I mean, the fact that for so many years, the actual role of the U.S. in Central American countries has been from bad to criminal, in the sense that we don't even need to go back too far back either. I mean, to go to the 1980s when the U.S. was actively supporting dictatorial right-wing regimes in Central America that did all sorts of horrible things, including killing priests, killing U.S. church women. We need to account for this to understand how much of a tall order it is for the U.S. to indeed be able to propose something that Central Americans ourselves can really take seriously. And yet the hopefully need, you know, suggests that we need to try because we are in a desperate situation in Central American countries. And if there is any chance whatsoever that we can actually move U.S. role in Central America to a somewhat less poisonous, less toxic role, willing to try it. I'm willing to give it a shot.
What do you think that the U.S. policies and practices should be, or what Biden and his emissary, Vice President Kamala Harris, what would you have hoped that they would say as the policies in Central America and Latin America now should be that would affect immigration and provide for the real opportunity for people to do what they want to do, which was to stay in their home country?
We don't have to get this to be complicated. We have another country in Central America, very close from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, and yet very different. And it is the case of Costa Rica. If we were to study what is it that Costa Rica did going back to the 1940s and forward to actually be where it is today, namely a country from where hardly anybody think of going away to fulfill their life aspirations, a country where people live fairly happy lives. And so if we were to back engineer what they did and actually learn the critical lessons of what they did and apply it, you know, to these other countries, we would be very much in the way to where we should be. And in my view, that involves acknowledging that economic inequality cannot be ignored, that we have put laws in place. And I say we because this is exactly another example of how the U.S. has not been just a passive observer, you know, in terms of what type of economic policies are in place in these countries that have made it possible for inequality, which was bad going back 50 years ago in each of these countries, has only become worse. Number two, we need to absolutely change tax policies so that the people who are making the most money and accumulating the most wealth in this country actually pays their fair share to be able to then invest in education, invest in access to healthcare, in housing standards that make sure that no one becomes homeless when a tropical storm comes about, that prepares these countries for the likely adversities that climate change will bring. So all that is absolutely critical. We need also countries absolutely committed to transparent ways of governing democratically, governments and economic elites that understand the importance of having truly separate powers when it comes to the judiciary, the legislative, and the executive branches, acting indeed in a way that puts at the very center of everything the well-being of people in a way that is transparent. Because what we have right now, it's far from anything I'm saying right now. And I think that that is the kind of approach that if the U.S. were to take, and again, I'm not talking about anything super radical, revolutionary. You know, nobody would call life in Costa Rica revolutionary. I mean, it is remarkably different than the life is in any of their northern, western neighbors in Central America. That is the kind of thing that they need to do. And there is another aspect that I highlight often, and it is the fact that if you take a look at who are the people investing in Central American countries, investing in Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador on a monthly basis. It is not any big corporation. It is not the World Bank. It is the very people from those countries who manage to successfully root themselves in the U.S. and who can afford to send remittances back home in amounts that are hard to imagine, because most Americans do not know that last year alone, Central Americans from these three countries sent nearly $23 billion in remittances, in family support, wires of money that have made life for those millions of households a lot less difficult than it would be without that support coming through. Can the U.S. begin to see the value that immigrants from these countries, as well as immigrants from Mexico, have for potentially a different U.S. policy towards Mexico, Central America, and other Latin American countries? I sure hope so. And I sure plan to keep insisting that that is as a matter of beginning, where we need to go if we are ever to change what these countries are and really turn them into places like Costa Rica, from where hardly anybody wants to flee.
Vice President Harris made some mention of some limited grants that the U.S. was making toward people on the ground with regard to affordable housing, with regard to entrepreneurs, especially farmers, and women's employment, on the order of like $40 million each, I believe. Is that a good first step, and what more could be done, especially given the corruption in the government there?
That is a positive micro step. The challenge of truly shifting the direction in which these countries are going will require a much more significant investment by not only the U.S., by, I would argue, the international community altogether. It would imply challenging at the core the type of entities the U.S. government has been working with in Central America up until today. If they expect different results by doing the same thing they've been doing before, perhaps in larger amounts of money, not, again, I mean, to the extent that they are needed, and they are planning to work with the same people they've been working before, we can absolutely rest assured that nothing will happen. That would be a certain formula for disaster. If you keep doing the same thing year after year and then hope for a different result, that means you are absolutely crazy.
Vice President Harris also went to Mexico. There hasn't been as much reporting on that. She did announce a grant of, I think, about $300 million to reform Mexican labor unions. Could you talk a little bit about that and whatever else you think is pertinent with regard to her trip to Mexico?
The reason why we haven't heard much about what transpired during the like 18 hours that the vice president was in Mexico is because Mexico is indeed a far more delicate, more complicated task. Unlike Central American countries, the U.S. government does have very long-standing, very deep economic interest in Mexico. And we have a government in Mexico that was very comfortable relating to the Trump administration. They reached an understanding with the Trump administration that basically said, the Mexican government said to Donald Trump, I will do whatever you need me to do in as far as stopping migration flows from Central America, and you let me do my things domestically the way I want them to be done. Trump was very comfortable with that arrangement. The Biden-Harris administration, emphasizing human rights, rule of law, and transparency, that becomes more complicated. In the view of many people, the president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has behaved in ways that are suggesting that he has a bit of an autocratic way of governing, and that in the process, he's been ignoring critical human rights issues in Mexico, ignoring the importance of separation of powers, and he's been definitely attacking press freedom in Mexico. Can the vice president of the U.S. come and say anything about that? Clearly not. They realize that unlike small players like Central American countries, getting into an argument with Mexico could potentially have consequences that they are not prepared to deal with. I do believe that the Mexico factor in the regional equation is a significantly more complicated task, and I don't envy Vice President Harris for having the responsibility she does, because I think it's going to be a very difficult issue to address and to resolve in a way in which the best interests of the majority of Mexicans are the interests that get the benefit.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court decision, its import, and what the media got wrong in the analysis, sure, not to mention the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court decision is regrettable because it makes life of people who already have had difficult lives in the U.S. even more complicated. The court was reviewing an immigration procedure known as adjustment of status. The couple that was the center of this lawsuit sought to be able to gain access to permanent residency visas, for which they have a petition where they are beneficiaries, without having to leave the U.S., using the fact that they were granted temporary protected status. It is an extremely thorough process. While they were beneficiaries of TPS, they managed to secure something known as advance parole. It's a special permit so that you can go out of the country while on TPS and then come back safely into the U.S. Because they had done both things, they expected that that would amount to qualifying them as legally admitted to the U.S. But what they found, you know, in the very last step of the process is that that step was denied to them on the basis that they did not originally enter the country with inspection, which is the legal term that is used to talk about that. Again, the court was only looking at that. And what they concluded is that if you were recipient of TPS, but you originally entered the country without a visa, even if you went to your own country and came back under an advance parole, you are still considered as not legally admitted to the country, and therefore you cannot access the so-called adjustment of status without leaving the U.S. territory. You have to go out of the U.S. territory to be able to actually get your visa. And at that point, such a foreign national may also face the consequences of something known as the 3- and 10-year bar, which is one clause of many in the 1996 immigration policy that it says that if you were in the country, even for one day without a visa, without a permission, without having entered properly into the country, you can face minimally 3, but most likely 10 years forced absence from the U.S. before you can be legally admitted.
Let's make it concrete. The two people that were the married couple that were involved in this, what's happening to them now?
They are actually still living the same lives that they've been living because, see, one thing that the decision announced last Monday did not change is the very nature of temporary protected status. So these two individuals who happen to be a couple, they remain protected by TPS in the U.S. What they cannot do, or I guess they could, but they may decide not to do, is to go out of the country to be able to finish the very last step of their permanent residency application into the U.S., the so-called green card. So if they decide to go outside of the country to finish the processing, they may well face this 3-10-year bar possibility. They may decide to stay in the U.S., but only under the protection of temporary protected status. And this is exactly what most media outlets got very wrong. The headings were basically to the effect of TPS recipients cannot qualify for green cards. And that is simply not true. That's not what the decision was about. And it did definitely cause more confusion within the community of people who are TPS recipients because all of a sudden, they felt threatened that even if tomorrow there is a possibility for them to access permanent residency visas, they may not be able to get it because of the way the media portray the decision made by the Supreme Court.
If indeed one does leave or is forced to leave, what really is going to happen? What is the likelihood of people ever, again, really being able to enter the country given the circumstances on the ground in their, quote, home country?
In order to really understand what we are talking about, one needs to go back to what happened in 1996. The country was infected with the idea that immigrants are some sort of threat that we needed to eliminate. And they passed an immigration policy reform, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, full of restrictions, exclusions, and punishment for immigrant communities. In my view, the ideal solution to the problems of many immigrants residing in the U.S. today would be for that particular law, the 1996 law, to be entirely abolished. It was based on a lie, on white supremacist ideas that have proven to be absolutely false. Immigration has been a beneficial process for the U.S. on many counts. And it's been also beneficial for millions of households in countries like Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, to the extent that people working here send money to their relatives back home. And by doing so, they actually help alleviate poverty, but certainly alleviate the conditions of life of their families back home. If that law remains in place, the life of immigrant communities will continue to be very much threatened periodically. The decision made by the Supreme Court made it actually very clear that if the Congress were to want to avoid this situation, namely someone like this couple, you know, but there are thousands of people like them who entered the U.S. without inspection, and yet they received temporary protected status. The decision clearly indicated to is if the Congress wanted to, they could easily modify existing law and simply make it clear that if you received something like TPS or DACA, that indeed constitutes legal admission to the U.S. And that would solve the problem of people being able to adjust their status into legal permanent residency visas without having to leave the country. But there are actually bills in the Congress now that would do exactly that, but they're just bills. I mean, they're not yet laws enacted.
And how many people are we talking about with this particular kind of TPS status implicated in this decision?
There are about 400,000 people, and that number is going to begin to change very quickly because, you know, Biden-Harris administration just recently granted a brand new designation of temporary protected status to people from Haiti. And that is something we absolutely applaud. We believe it's the right decision. What it means is that if we do not take into account these brand new recipients of TPS from Haiti and from Burma, which also got a TPS recently, we are talking about altogether 500,000 people, you know, who are in the U.S. And many of them, I cannot really estimate accurately what percentage of that 500,000 are actually people who entered originally the United States of America without a visa. And when I say a visa, I mean a visitor visa, student visa, a temporary worker visa, any so-called non-immigrant visa would count, you know, because any of those visas implies that a foreign national entered to the U.S. and they were stamped coming into the U.S., which constitutes legal admission into the U.S.
Oscar Chacon, Executive Director of Alianza Americas, thank you for joining us and for the work you do. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.